Hello, friends. I'm Alan Kirshner from Eschatos Ministries. As a Christian, you can't help but hear the news and watch the turmoil of our day and know that the return of Christ is nearing. Bible Prophecy Daily is committed to the daily feeding of God's people to make overcomers. But there is a material cost to this global outreach. Please consider committing to giving to Eschatos Ministries on a monthly basis. You can easily do so by clicking the support button in the corner at the podcast website at BibleProphecyDaily.com. We appreciate you and pray that God will bless and strengthen you. Thank you.
You're listening to Bible Prophecy Daily, a weekday podcast where Bible prophecy matters and matters greatly.
Hey, Marquis Laughlin here with another edition of Bible Prophecy Daily. This is a great podcast, has several teachers on it, and we are giving views and teaching about the end times. We enjoy having you and answering your questions. Of course, you can email me at any time and ask me questions about every podcast or things you can't find other places, and we will dig to find them. It may take us a little bit to get back, but we're a pretty responsive group, and we're all have a passion to share what we are discovering in the scriptures. And indeed, there's a lot that is being uncovered. We're in the middle of what I call a director's commentary. One of my frustrations as a presenter of scripture, I perform scripture. I've been performing the book of Revelation since 1994 and seven other books of the Bible from memory, traveling around the world and mostly the United States, doing 30 to 50 presentations a year. One of my problems, the challenges I had, was traditional commentaries. They were inadequate to answer some of the simplest questions, and I know you've probably found that to be true as you search a commentary to answer what you think is a pretty simple question, like who's talking here, and why are they saying what they're saying? And why is this here as opposed to someplace else? And is it important? Isn't it? How important is it? What does it relate to? Things a fifth grader would ask. Those are the kind of questions that I enjoy finding the answers to, because they're often overlooked in favor of what I would call things that are fairly insignificant minutiae that really serve to more to impress us with the author's ability to search the scriptures rather than actually give us something spiritual that is more meat and potatoes, that is actually edifying. So that's why I do this Revelation commentary. We go through each chapter. If you haven't been following this, all of the podcasts up to this week, we're at chapter 14 this week, and we're also did chapter 15 for this month, so next month there'll be two more chapters, but all of the previous episodes are available at Bible Prophecy Daily, the podcast where the show link is. So just want to open up getting into why a director's commentary. Well, these are, I'm going to try to focus on bigger questions that are harder to find the answer to. And I'm going to try to give you context that sometimes is easier to put to articulate when we use the metaphors of a movie. We're watching the future in advance when we're reading Bible prophecy. We're looking at the trailers as the coming attractions, the previews of the future. And as God is the master storyteller, oftentimes we get a lot more information about one particular thing that happens, scene that happens. We can see it a lot more clearly when we get different camera angles. I remember a few years back there was a movie called Vantage Point, and it had several stars in it, but it was about one event, an assassination attempt. And it showed the event from several camera angles, which basically they use different characters to show you the event over and over again, but you were just seeing it from different angles. And so you were still trying to figure out exactly what happened because you kept being surprised every time they showed the story from somebody else's perspective, the exact same story. A lot of information, additional details were added, and it really gave you a much better understanding of what happened in that particular scene at that particular moment. So with that said, that's kind of what we do when, you know, if there's an assassination attempt on the president, you start to, you know, there's another angle, there's another camera angle. Well, that's what we're trying to do with Bible Prophecy with this director's commentary on Revelation. We're trying to look at these things from different camera angles. And that's one of the challenges I found when I memorized Revelation is that his storytelling is very Middle Eastern. It's biblical. It's the way God tells his story biblically. And it's very consistent with the style of storytelling that's more Mediterranean or Middle Eastern. You tell the same story over and over again, essentially, but you tell it from different camera angles to give people more and more information and more detail. And the more times you tell it, the more emphasis on the sequence of events that is going to happen, and the more detail that you get with the story. It's very hard to get one camera angle and get all of the information. And as you know, you swing the camera around the room and, oh, wait a minute, I didn't see that behind that person. That makes sense why that happened. So that's what we're trying to do here. Obviously, we did Revelation chapter 13, that is in the archives now, and great chapter that describes, just to kind of set up today's teaching, Revelation chapter 13 describes the careers, the rise of the Antichrist and the rise of the false prophet, his right-hand man, and what they do. And it wraps up with the false prophet introducing the mark of the beast and the result of basically saying, hey, if anybody takes this, you know, they're toast. And that is a huge warning about not taking this mark, which is the culmination, really, of the power of the Antichrist being used by the false prophet to enforce this law that results in the martyrdom, murder, jailing of many believers. And then we're, of course, given... So that's a very sobering thing. So that has just taken place in the Revelation narrative as we get to chapter 14. And what I'm going to do is read chapter 14 for you. And as I read it, I will stop and try to give some commentary in between. But that's where we are. We're at the height of the Antichrist power. And he has just implemented the mark of the beast on the right hand or on the forehead that you have to take, and you have to bow down to worship him or his image. And so the false prophet has just instigated that. So that is what's going on in the world. That's what's going on in the Revelation story. Obviously, we can pretty much surmise, because that is what's going on. Those things are predicted to happen in the second half of Daniel's 70th week, or what Jesus referred to as the Great Tribulation. Remember, he said that time would be cut short for the sake of the elect. So you have a 3.5-year period of time that has been described in Scripture over and over again, that is going to begin with the Antichrist going into the temple, proclaiming himself to be God, demanding the worship of everyone. It's going to move to the false prophet making everybody take this mark, from there to a martyrdom and jailing and killing believers and Jewish people. So that persecution on Israel and on the church, that is going to really take out quite a few people. So that is the... That's the texture of those times. Now, of course, we also have a few other characters that are probably in this particular scene, but Moses and Elijah, or i.e. the two witnesses, some of you might think Enoch might be one of them, but obviously, definitely Elijah and very possibly Moses are going to be the two witnesses, and they're going to be sharing their testimony in all likelihood during this time frame. Remember, when they share their testimony, they're going to do it for 3.5 years. It is not going to rain. 3.5 years obviously correlates. It seems to correlate with the reign of the Antichrist and the false prophet, but we that's an assumption we're making. We do know they go head to head. We're told that the beast overpowers the two witnesses, and they are killed in Jerusalem. And the world celebrates, sends each other gifts, and they refuse to bury these men for 3 days, 3.5 days. So very fascinating. Obviously, it is because of their resurrection and the event that happens right after they are resurrected after 3.5 days. They hear a voice from heaven say, come up here. They come up to go up to heaven in a cloud. We do know that that means that they are going to... there's a great earthquake, and a tenth of the city of Jerusalem collapses, and many people died during the collapse. 7,000 people are killed, probably mostly Israelis, in Jerusalem, and the survivors are terrified and give glory to the God of heaven. So if they're giving glory to the God of heaven, and they're surviving Jews after the ministry of the two witnesses, we know that that has got to be very close to the end of Daniel's 70th week, or that 3.5 year period of time. So these are the kind of things that are happening that we know. That's the context, okay? Very tough times of persecution, Jesus called this particular time frame, this particular period, a very difficult time to be alive. And he said that there would not be a worse time. There would never be, there never has been, and there never will be a worse time. So it's bad news if you're following God and the Lord or Jesus, and or even if you're Israeli. It's just a rough time. So that's what he's describing. We're at the height of that. And then John looks in chapter 14. He says, and let me pick it up with verse 1 of chapter 14. He says, then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. Now, and then he says in verse 2, and I heard a voice from heaven, like the roar of many waters, and like the sound of loud thunder. The voice I heard was like that of harpists playing on their harps, and they were singing a new song before the throne, that's the throne in heaven, and before the four living creatures, and before the elders. Those are all beings in heaven, which is why we know they were, the Lamb is standing on the Mount Zion of God, the heavenly Mount Zion. He is standing there with 144,000 is from all the tribes of Israel, we learned from chapter 7 earlier in the book of Revelation. And he is not on earth, he is in heaven. The sound comes from the throne. The elders and the four living creatures are before the throne of God in heaven. So it's the heavenly Mount Zion. And there's also other clues that would totally indicate that. So, and I know that throws a lot of people. They think, oh, Jesus is down here on earth on Mount Zion. No, there is a heavenly Jerusalem and an earthly Jerusalem. There's a heavenly Mount Zion and an earthly Mount Zion. And this is, we're locating this scene. I'm trying to locate this scene for you. So if you can imagine, in the heavenly Mount Zion, Jesus is standing on the heavenly Mount Zion with the 144,000 Jews who have been sealed. Remember, they were sealed in chapter 7 so that they would not experience the wrath of God, which we're learning is about to be poured out. So they're sealed. And they, it goes on to say, no one could learn that song, the song they're singing, except these 144,000 who had been redeemed from the earth. They were redeemed from the earth. They're literally the first fruits of Israel. And you'll find this concept, the first fruits, consistently in the scriptures. The idea is when God goes to harvest something, he takes the first fruits. And you remember, you'd do a wave offering of the first fruits, and then the harvest would come later. But this was your giving your first of your fruits to God. It's we tithe to really kind of imitate this way of honoring God with the first parts of our wealth. So that's what this is. This is a look. Here's Jesus's first fruits of the redemption of Israel. That's who the 144,000 represent. So they sing a song nobody can learn except them, and it describes them. It is these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. And in their mouths was no lie was found, for they are blameless. Now, here's where it really gets interesting. So he's got this first fruits of Israel. It's really a dream come true there for God. He's been longing to be able to gather Israel to himself. Like Jesus said, I long to gather you together like a bird or chicken gathering her flocks together and just putting her wings over the chicks, you know. And here's literally, he's essentially doing that for the first fruits of Israel. And then John says, then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on the earth. So an angel comes flying over them and yells down to the earth past them. They're in heaven now. He has a message to proclaim to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, and language and people. And he says with a loud voice, fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. And worship him who made heaven and earth, the sea, and the springs of water. Now, this is pretty fascinating. You know, we're called to take the gospel to the ends of the world. That's Jesus giving us the Great Commission, right? But here is the completion of that task. It's completed ultimately by an angel. He goes out to all of the ends of the world, and he makes this really a last call announcement that everyone hears. Pretty fascinating. So our prayers for the gospel to go to the ends of the earth, they are literally going to be ultimately answered prophetically. So pretty cool. So then he says, then John writes, another angel, a second one, followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who made all nations drink the wine of the passion of her sexual immorality. Now, this is fascinating because, whoa, he is talking about Babylon the Great, and he's saying that she polluted the whole world with her sexual immorality. Pretty fascinating. So she is largely to blame. I think some of the times we think this Antichrist and the false prophet are such bad guys, but we forget about Babylon the Great, who gets huge judgment and huge blame for all of the evil that's propagated on the earth when Jesus returns. So that's just an emphasis thing that I see. It's a kind of, she's not really given credit for how bad she is and how God judges her so horribly. So that's the second angel who comes by. Now the third angel says, he says, and another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast and its image and receives a mark on his forehead or on his hand, he also will drink the wine of God's wrath, poured full strength into the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. And they have no rest, day or night, these worshippers of the beast and its image, and whoever receives the mark of its name. Now listen to this, verse 12. Here is a call for the endurance of the saints, those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. Now that's flagrant non-pre-trib verse right there. Because why would we have a call for the endurance of the saints? We know we're the saints. Those who keep the commandments of God, that's what we do, and their faith in Jesus, that's what we do. Why would they call us saints if we're actually redeemed Jews were part of the first fruits of the 144,000. These are believers in Jesus, literally, and they're called to endure. And remember, the warning about worshiping the beast or receiving the mark of its name. You cannot survive receiving the mark of the beast. It is always connected with the worship of the beast. It's irrevocable. There is something in it that disqualifies you from salvation. There is something inherent, some mojo, whether it's genetic, whether it's a virus, there's something in the mark, something about taking the mark that changes you, because we're going to see later, and we saw earlier in chapter 8 of Revelation, there are things that happen to people who take the mark that are exclusive to people who take the mark, that happen to everyone who takes the mark. So you can't take it and I'm going to take it just to function financially, but I really believe in God. There's no example of anyone in the in-between on this. You're either in or you're out. There's no gray area. So very, very, very stern warnings about this. So we have the call, because of the warning, for the saints to endure, which would indicate the saints are still around trying to endure, which is exactly what Jesus told us about this time period. It would be hard to endure. Now, here is what when we hear some familiar voices. See if you can figure out who these are. Chapter 14, verse 13, right after the call for the endurance of the saints and those who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And then he says, "And I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Blessed indeed, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them." Now, isn't that interesting? You have what appears to be either Jesus or God the Father saying, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. And the Spirit saying, blessed indeed, seconding either the Father or the Son, saying that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow them. Now, that's a clue as to what's about to happen. They're going to rest as opposed to run and hide and be martyred and punished, because Jesus is coming to harvest the earth. And the very next verse, verse 14 of chapter 14, it says, "Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud." Now remember, Revelation says, "Behold, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him." This is what John is seeing when he tells you that at the beginning of Revelation. He is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, and all the peoples of the earth will mourn because of him. All the peoples of the earth, the ones making people take the mark, they're going to mourn because they're not happy that when they see Jesus, and they're going to know who it is, and they're going to be able to see his face. So here we go, chapter 14, verse 14. It says, "Then I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man." That's Jesus' favorite title for himself. And he says, "With a crown of a golden crown on his head, and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud." See, the angel comes out of the temple in heaven and calls to Jesus, who is sitting on the cloud, and he says, "Put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe." So he who sat on the cloud, the Son of Man, Jesus, swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. Now this is, this is exactly, if you remember in Matthew, I think chapter 13, this is the description that Jesus gave when he talked about the harvest of the earth and the end of the age, and how he would send his angels out to harvest. And remember, we don't want to tear separate the wheat and the tares, because you may pull up some wheat along with them. At the end of the age, I'll send my angels out, and they will, they'll tie the wheat up into bundles to be burned and like chaff, and they'll harvest the wheat. So Jesus says he's going to send his angels out to do that. This is exactly the picture of the Son of Man, Jesus, doing just that, sending his angels out to gather us together in the clouds with him and to gather up the wheat and tie them into bundles. And by taking that mark, you're tied into that bundle. That's the complete separation of the wheat and the tares, those who take the mark and those who don't. So even in that picture, it's very vivid and very, very literal of what Jesus intends to do at the end of the age with his angels as he sends them out. And of course, we have a great picture of that in Revelation chapter 7, right there. So, you know, you have 6 and 7, the sign of Jesus coming in the clouds, and you have the separation of the wheat and the tares, and you have a great crowd of people from all over the world, believers standing in front of the throne with white robes on, shouting, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." You know, that basically, you saved us. You are the one who saves. An amazing scene, but we're seeing yet another camera angle on that scene. So we're getting to see this same sequence of events over and over again in the book of Revelation. And indeed, this sequence of events appears in John's gospel when Jesus talks to Martha, telling her that he is the resurrection and the life. When he talks about when he meets Mary, when Mary meets him and then calls Martha because Lazarus has died, Martha comes out and he says, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies." Those are the resurrected saints. "And whoever believes in me will never die." Those are some of the people that are going to be alive. Some of the people that are going to be alive that don't take the mark of the beast when he comes in the clouds and send his angels out. So you have this whole sequence again. And of course, this sequence is also in the book of Daniel. So if you look in just those places, and it's in the Psalms, it's the same scene, but you get a little more information. Okay, then in verse 17 of chapter 14 of Revelation, he goes on to say, "Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and he too had a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar." Now, remember, in Revelation, the last time we saw the altar was, well, one of the last times was chapter 5. Remember, there were souls, martyred souls, under the altar, and they were crying out, "How long, sovereign Lord, holy and true, until you judge the inhabitants of the earth and avenge our blood?" But they were told to wait a little longer. They're given white robes. But now, in this scene, we're seeing their prayer being answered. They were told to wait a little longer till the full number of their fellow servants and brothers who were to be killed as they had been was completed. But now that's completed, and so Jesus is taking people out, and he's going to judge the earth as he's promised them. So another angel came out from the altar, from those who were going, "God, how long?" The angel who has authority over the fire, remember, fire and brimstone was the very first judgment God called down, the very first trumpet. And he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle. He said, "Put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, for its grapes are ripe." So the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the grape harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress as high as a horse's bridles for 1,600 stadia. So what does that mean? It's a picture of Jesus trampling the winepress, treading the winepress of the wrath of God Almighty. It's Revelation chapter 19. It's Armageddon. Jesus fights the kings of the earth and treads their blood in the winepress of God's wrath. He pours his wrath out. That's why his robe is red when he returns on a horse. That's why his robe is red. He's been, what does the psalm say? "Where have you been? I've been treading the winepress of the wrath of God. No one helped me." I can't remember what psalm that is, but it's a great psalm that describes this very scene, part of the very scene. So John's giving us another camera angle on Jesus taking vengeance literally on his enemies. So this is pretty heavy stuff. It takes us right up to the end of chapter 14, takes us right up to chapter 15, where we have a little interlude right before the seven plagues are introduced, the seven bowl judgments. And so we'll get into the timing of that. But I believe all these things are, they are one after another. They are sequential. As a matter of fact, a lot of times, like right here, the seventh trumpet actually has the seventh trumpet literally contains the seven bowl judgments. So you have to have one happen before the other. That's my point. So hopefully that's helped you. If you have some questions, feel free to give me a call, or not give me a call, but shoot me an email, easier for me. You can send it to marquis@actsoftheword.com. That's M-A-R-Q-U-I-S @actsoftheword.com, or just visit my website, actsoftheword.com. And I'll try to help you and answer any questions you have. But until next time, when we'll get into chapter 15, Maranatha, and may God bless you.
Thanks for listening to Bible Prophecy Daily. We hope you learned something valuable today. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode.